So today I'm here with Christian Kiesers, who is a neuroscientist from the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience, and he's based in Amsterdam. So Christian, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you maybe just, before we talk about like work stuff, just tell us a little bit about your background and who you are?
So I'm half French and half German. I was born in Belgium, lived in various countries in Europe, including Italy, the UK, the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany. And I spent a bit over a year in Boston as well. And I got really interested in the brain relatively early in my kind of school time, and went on to study psychology, and then really got into brain science when I was about 20.
So are you an MD doctor, or are you a psychologist, or like what?
Yeah, so my first degree was in psychology and biology, and then basically you pick up the neuroscience stuff as you start to do research in neuroscience.
And so now your focus is on, actually, maybe why don't you just tell us then specifically about what it is you're doing right now?
Well, so the big question that fascinates me is how people can understand other people. I mean, say you watch, for instance, a James Bond movie, say Dr. No, with the spider crawling on James Bond. The thing is, you don't really need to think to feel what is going on in this person. And that is actually quite surprising, because if you think about it, things like fear or intentions are things that we know happen inside of people's brain. So how come that while we're just looking at them from the outside, we kind of very intuitively feel all of these hidden things that happen inside of them, like their intentions and fears? So my big question is basically, that's driving my research, is how we go from kind of seeing facial expressions into movement of people to really feel what goes on inside of them.
And so would you focus that primarily around mirror neurons, or would you focus that around a broader set of things?
So then I got really interested in the topic through mirror neurons. So I used to work in visual neuroscience, where the big question is how the brain puts kind of the information that enters your eyes together to make you see the world. But then you very quickly get to the point where you figure, okay, so now I see somebody smile, I can understand how the brain kind of makes me see the smile, but how do I know that that person is happy? And to try to find an answer to that, and then move to Italy, where the team in Parma had just discovered mirror neurons, to be part of that enterprise.
Oh, so you worked with the original team that did it with monkeys in the 90s?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So I was part of that effort. And so what made that so fascinating in a way is that So what mirror neurons are is that the neurons in the motor part of the monkey's brain, so if you, say, stimulate that part of the brain, what you see is that the monkey will start doing stuff, for instance, grasping a peanut in front of him. But what we see is that these motor areas actually got reactivated if we would do something, the same thing, in front of the monkey. So that showed me that the brain does not just see what other people do, but it kind of transforms it into the vocabulary of your own actions. It makes you feel what it would feel like to do the actions you see.
Right. Can you go on.
So that was the beginning, kind of the core mirror neurons. But the core mirror neurons are about actions, kind of you see somebody drink, and it activates your motor program for drinking. But of course, we know that understanding other people depends on more than that. So if you see somebody cry, for instance, you don't just feel the kind of action of crying, you also kind of feel the sadness that's behind it. So after kind of helping to really discover the mirror neurons, one of my big questions was whether something similar might exist for sensations and emotions. And what we did find is basically that if you feel sad, or if you feel disgusted, for instance, by something, or whether you see somebody else be disgusted, you actually activate the very same part of your brain. So it's similar to mirror neurons, but it shows that this kind of sharing is not just about what other people do, but as well about what other people feel.
Can you talk about, were you there that when, because my understanding is when mirror neurons were discovered, there was no, that was not expected at all. Were you there when that originally happened?
No, so I wasn't there. I joined the team kind of 2 years after they made the first kind of publications and observation. But you're completely right. It wasn't expected at all. So the team was studying this area of the brain, this motor part of the brain, just to understand how a monkey or a human can actually control his own actions. And so the way you do that is that you put little electrodes in the brain of the monkey. The brain doesn't feel any pain, so the monkey is not aware that there's an electrode in his brain. And so you can listen into what single neurons do while you actually interact with the monkey. And so they quickly realized that the neurons there were involved in relatively high-level aspects of an action, something like wanting to take an object. And then it was only by mistake, or so to speak, or by accident, that they noticed that each time they took an object to then present it to the monkey to see what the neuron would do when the monkey takes it, that even while they were taking it, basically, the neuron was firing as if the monkey had done the action. So it was pure coincidence. And in the beginning, they didn't even believe that it was real. It was only then, after checking all the possible confounds, that they're slowly warmed up to the idea that a part of the brain that was supposed just to take care of your own actions would actually be involved in perceiving the actions of others.
So, I mean, the story that I read was like one of the researchers was coming down with an ice cream or something, and then that started setting it off. Was that right, or was it?
No, that's an invention. It wasn't an ice cream. It was peanuts that you give to the monkey that the experimenter was taking. But I mean, you're right in really that it was by mistake, and it could have been an ice cream, just happened to be a peanut.
And so when a mirror neuron fires, I guess you have it rigged up and you just hear like a noise on the machine behind you, like a tick or something like that. Is that, like, how does it sound?
Exactly. So what you do is basically the neuron, when a neuron fires, it just sets off a little impulse that lasts a thousandth of a millisecond. So what you do is you amplify it and put it on a loudspeaker. Then it really sounds like a little pop, 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 pop sound. And when the neuron is kind of not doing much, it sounds a bit like this, kind of pop, pop, pop. And then when you grasp for something, it starts to really go brrrr, kind of a really strong discharge of activity.
So what you're saying is, like, a mirror neuron is generally firing a little bit all the time, but the frequency goes up massively when it's being activated. Is that right?
True, but that's true for any neuron in the brain. There's something that is called spontaneous activity, which is just a little bit of a background activity. And that allows then the neuron to either signal kind of more of what it normally signals by increasing the frequency, and in some cases it can reduce the frequency as well to really signal that there's that the opposite is true. But so in this case, indeed, you kind of have the slow background activity that then ramps up to 50 or 100 spikes a second when it sees an action or when the monkey does an action himself.
So are we saying, like, maybe it's firing regularly at one time a second, and then when it's firing quickly, it goes to 100 times a second? Would that be right?
Exactly, yeah, that's about right.
And what is it? What does actually a mirror neuron look like? Is this something you can actually see?
Well, so the methods we use don't actually look with a microscope in the brain. So what we just do is we have these little electrodes that are like antennas, and they just basically capture the firing, a bit like people could capture the pulse from Sputnik back in the old days. But based on the shape of the spikes we get, and so they seem to be relatively standard neurons. We call them pyramidal neurons. They're just like any other neuron that's involved in programming your own actions. What makes them special is that they seem to receive the right input from the visual part of your brain to also respond when you see a similar action done by somebody else.
But so, I mean, in terms of like actual size in the brain, are they like, you know, a centimeter big, or are they like a millimeter big, or like, you know, like how big is a mirror neuron?
Well, you can imagine that in a volume, say, of 1 by 1 by 1 millimeter, you could have something like 1,000 mirror neurons and mixed amongst maybe 100,000 other neurons.
Oh, okay. And so when you guys are testing for them, are you able to isolate down to a single mirror neuron, or are you at a group?
No, you really, what you do is you use electrodes that really just take in signals that are incredibly close to the tip of the electrode. And you do that so that when you hear something, you're sure it's a single neuron. And that's why we're so sure it's the same neuron firing when the monkey does something and when the monkey sees somebody else do something. You can, of course, use different electrodes where you manage to listen into hundreds of neurons at the same time, but then you can no longer really know whether it's the same neuron doing two things. So we literally went through them one at a time to find the mirror neurons amongst those motor neurons.
And so, I mean, by the scale that you're talking about, there's literally like, what, is there like a million different neurons in there, and you just isolated this little patch called mirror neurons?
Well, so they're not in a little patch. So if you wish, you have this part of the brain that's maybe a couple of centimeters squared that programs the monkey's action. And in there you have a lot of neurons that are just involved in doing the monkey's own actions. And then you have kind of 10% of them have this additional property to also respond when you see the actions of other people. And so in my time in Parma, I've probably recorded from something like 200 mirror neurons and something like 2,000 regular neurons.
Hmm. And so do you think, have you mapped for a monkey, have you mapped all the different mirror neurons, or is that 200 out of maybe 20,000 of them?
Oh, no. So that'd be in, you have to keep in mind there's about 10 to the power of 10 neurons in the brain. So that's a lot of zeros. That's about 10 billion neurons in a brain. And so basically, you know, we just explored, say, 2,000 neurons while I was there. And of those, about 200 turned out to be mirror neurons. But there's literally billions more.
But so how many mirror neurons do you think there are?
Well, a rough estimate would be somewhere around 10 million.
Oh, so you've mapped 200 out of 10 million.
Yes.
All right. So you got a little bit more work to do there.
Yes, exactly.
All right. And so, I mean, I went looking for videos of this on YouTube. I mean, is this where the monkey's there with his head cut open? Like, you know, what happens to the monkey at the end of this?
No. So what we do is they're actually we interact with these monkeys for years. They're really You can imagine we work sometimes 6 hours a day with them. They're really like pets that we have. And the implants are really very small little implants. You can imagine if you take a bottle of Coke, one of these big bottles, and you would basically just cut off the top where you can unscrew the cap. Well, that's about the size of the implant. So what you do is, under full anesthesia, you put this this little cap on top of the monkey's head so that you can slowly carve out the bone there. And then you expose that little part of the brain, and the brain is not pain sensitive. So then on any given day when you need to record from a monkey, you basically just open the cap, and you have a little manipulator in which you enter with something that's much thinner even than a hypodermic needle. I mean, it's thinner than a hair. And you just enter with that slowly through the cortex, listening in. Each time you hear a neuron, you stop. You try to find out what the neuron does, and the monkey is not aware of that. So you just kind of interact with the monkey. You kind of give him a peanut, an apple. You try to get him to do things with his hand, with his mouth, always listening to what the neuron does, till you find really the action that when the monkey does it, always activates that neuron. And then you know, okay, say this is a neuron that's involved in breaking a peanut. And then what you can do is, while you're still listening into the neuron, is you then take a peanut, you break it yourself, and you see whether that excites the neuron. If it does, you know it's a mirror neuron. Then, for instance, you can go stand behind the monkey, break a peanut, to check whether the sound of breaking a peanut also does the job. And it turns out that it does. And then you can run a couple of trials to really quantify all of that. And then once you're satisfied that you understood what the neuron does, you then advance a little bit more with this electrode.
But just before you go on, when you move behind him and you check via the sound, was that the same mirror neuron that fired as via sight?
Yes, yes. So that was one of the kind of works I really did in Palma, was to establish the fact that mirror neurons do not only respond to the sight of other people's actions, but also to their sound. And so you may remember, for instance, the famous radio advert that Coca-Cola had for a while, you know, where they just open the Coca-Cola bottle, then pour in the Coca-Cola drink from it and go, ah.
Right.
And it really made you long for something to drink yourself. And I think that the kind of mirror neurons that we found that also respond just to the sound of an action, like biting or drinking or these kind of actions, the fact that you basically share the actions that you hear kind of can explain why these radio adverts can be so powerfully engaging.
Are you familiar with NLP, neuro-linguistic programming?
Vaguely, yes. Actually, my sister tells me about it.
I mean, they have a concept called anchoring. Have you heard of that concept?
No.
So the way they talk about anchoring is when something happens that you get like an emotional feeling, and then that feeling anchoring is then what it's basically what records it in the brain. So let's say you're out on a hot day and you're feeling like you really want to drink, and then you open the bottle, you know, it's a bottle of Coke or whatever, and you hear that, you know, that noise when it opens. Because it's that hot day, you really want that Coke, you start to associate that sound. I guess it's a little bit like the Pavlov's dog, you know, the bell type stuff. But you associate that, you start to associate that noise with that feeling. And so then when you hear that ad, then that's what kind of, you know, that's kind of from, I'm coming at it from the other side.
Well, that's interesting because so in my book I try to explain this idea that I have of how mirror neurons actually emerge. And the thing is, in neuroscience, there's this concept that's called Hebbian learning.
Right.
It has been rephrased as what fires together, wires together. And my idea is indeed...
Actually, just before we go on, I'll just explain it as I understand it, because that's a complicated concept, and just so people haven't heard it. So the way I understand Hebbian learning is it's kind of like there's neural pathways in the brain, and the way to think about it is imagine goats in a big field, and the goats might walk around the field in certain areas, and they'll start to walk around in certain paths. And as they start to use those paths more, they basically wear and become deeper over time. And so those become the pathways that then become more used. And that's kind of Hebbian learning, is saying that as you start to do things a certain way, then you continue doing it more that way. Does that sound accurate?
Yes, no, that's very accurate. I mean, the way then it really looks in the brain is that you have to imagine if you have two of these little neurons that happen to often be active at the same time, then we know that the connection between those two neurons, which is kind of the path in the field of your goats, for instance, becomes thicker. And it's because the connections between neurons are called synapses, and they have the potential to go bigger or smaller depending on how often the two neurons fire together.
And you're actually able to see these pathways become thicker, eh?
Well, I personally have not done the kind of experiments to do that, but other neuroscientists have. So Eric Kandel, for instance, who won a Nobel Prize more or less for that, and did very in-depth studies of how these paths become thicker because of kind of correlated firing. But to bring it back now to the case of anchoring that you were saying in mirror neurons, what you have to imagine is we don't think that kids actually born, say, with mirror neurons for what it feels like to drink Coca-Cola. I don't think that evolution equipped us with that.
They haven't figured out how to sponsor that yet, but I believe there may be scientists working on that.
Yes, I think they probably do. But so the idea is indeed that when you, for the first time, for instance, open a Coca-Cola can and hear this hissing sound, then what will happen is that the neurons in your brain that make you open the can will be active at the same time as the neurons that make you hear the hissing. And because they're going to be active together every time you open a Coca-Cola can, you'll get this strong association, which in the brain will be done by getting thicker connections between the motor neuron and the auditory neuron.
Right.
And if you've done that a couple of times, if you then hear somebody else open a Coca-Cola can, you activate one of the two neurons, and through the thicker connections, it will then activate your motor program that you used in the past to cause the same sound. And therefore, it's just this pairing or anchoring, like you were saying,
right,
between doing an action and seeing and hearing what it's like, that will wire up your brain so that it has mirror neurons and can then activate the motor program if you see or hear the actions of others.
Exactly. And the only thing I would add on to that is if the intensity of the emotional experience is higher, the frequency needs to be less. So if it's a fairly small thing that you're anchoring, then you would need the frequency you need maybe to have 100 times before that connection is really made. Whereas if it happens one time, let's say you're standing in the street and you see a small child in the road and then, you know, a car like runs over the kid, then that's going to form some pretty strong connections in your brain right away.
Correct. And we know partially what happens there is that if you have these very strongly emotional situations, then your brain sets out a whole lot of hormones like adrenaline and as well things like dopamine and so. They were washed pretty much throughout the entire brain. But what then happens is that if you then have two neurons that fire together, then these hormones give the synapses that connect them the information to really kind of learn the thing more strongly than they would normally do. And like you say, they would replace then 100 associations with a single association plus all the kind of hormones that happen in these very strong, stressful situations.
Hmm. So there's been some researchers that have been working with patients that have epilepsy out in California, and they've been actually like they've confirmed their mirror neurons in humans, and I guess they've been doing some, they've been cutting people's heads open and doing what you've been doing with monkeys. Do you know much about that experiment and what they've been doing?
Yes. So I know actually Mukamel, who's the postdoc that did the work pretty well, and then so these are very exciting studies. Because so the reason you do these studies is that many people that have epilepsy just respond to medication and they live a nice life like that. Some of the patients happen to have a case of epilepsy where the medication doesn't work anymore. And then what the surgeon needs to do is find a place in the brain that's the epicenter, so where the epileptic fit starts. And if you cut that part out, then you actually get rid of the epilepsy. But so to do that, what they do is they implant electrodes in the head of a human patient, much like we did in the monkeys, and then wait for the next fit to happen, because then they can triangulate the location of the fit with a precision that you cannot do by just using non-invasive methods. And so while the surgeon, in that case, Isaac Fried, is waiting for the next fit to happen, you can ask the patients if they're willing for you to run an experiment with these electrodes that are already in their head. And kind of taking advantage of that, Roy Mukamel then had people, for instance, watch other people grasp or make facial expressions, and then he asked the patients to do the same, and he could find that some neurons, again in the motor cortex, would actually respond in both cases, showing the first kind of evidence in humans as well that single neurons are active in both cases.
And have they done as much research? Like, you guys have like analyzed 200 of the, I guess, 2 million total mirror neurons. Have they done like that level of research, or have they?
No, not at all. So the thing that happens is that most of the research we do in humans, we do using fMRI. So what fMRI allows you to do is measure brain activity in little cubes of, say, 3 millimeters by 3 millimeters by 3 millimeters. And if that part of the brain is used because you're doing something, then it needs more oxygen. And what you can do is you can visualize with fMRI how much oxygen is being sent to each part of the brain. And so doing that, we have over the years accumulated a lot of evidence that the same brain regions in humans as well become activated both when a subject does something and when he sees somebody else do something. The problem is that once you've identified that this little cube of 3 millimeters is active both during observation and execution, because there are millions of neurons within that cube, you're not sure that it's actually the same neuron being active in both cases. So based on what we knew in the monkeys that mirror neurons exist, and based on the fact that with this fMRI we had seen that humans as well activate the same brain areas, all it took was listening to a couple of hundreds of neurons in humans to find a couple of mirror neurons, and that was then really the proof that this activation we had seen with fMRI reflecting mirror neurons.
So that makes sense. And I've been reading about fMRI, and my understanding of it, and I guess it sounds like what you're saying is, like, we're really in almost prehistoric times with that stuff. I mean, you're literally like a little old lady with Coke bottle glasses, like trying to peer into things and barely able to see. I mean, we just don't really have any resolution with fMRI yet. So it's not like, I mean, when you're like putting electrodes in a monkey's brain, you're dealing with, you know, single pixel resolution, whereas fMRI, you're dealing with like a million pixel rip, you know.
Exactly. I mean, it's a little bit the difference between kind of sending a spy into the drug cartel versus looking at it from a military satellite. Kind of, it's just kind of going in with the electrodes gives you the kind of insight about what individual neurons do that you cannot get at all with fMRI. fMRI has some advantages, though, of its own, which is the fact that you can see the whole picture, basically the whole pattern of activity in the entire brain at once. And that allows you to kind of get insights about how different brain areas play together and which brain areas are involved, which would take hundreds of years to do, of course, if you poke with electrodes and get a single neuron at a time. So they're kind of complementary methods. We need both. And using both, we can get both the details and the big picture.
So if I'm a monkey and you've got me in an fMRI machine and you hand me, or you pick up a peanut, what is the neural activity that you're going to see when that happens?
Well, so then if you were to put a monkey or a human in an fMRI and show him somebody grasping, what you'll see is that roughly about half of the brain areas that are normally involved in doing the action will become reactivated. So now what happens? So if if you're in the scanner and you grasp for peanut yourself, I'd see activity in what is called the primary motor cortex that's pretty directly connected to your muscles. And then I'd see activity in premotor cortices, which are kind of higher programming areas. It's a bit like the primary motor cortex are the soldiers, and the premotor cortex are kind of the generals that decide what needs to be done. And then if I now show you the actions of somebody else, what I'd see is that the high-level areas, so the generals, will be active as if they'd be doing the actions themselves, but the little soldiers will not. And that's why you don't always imitate every action you see other people do, because the brain kind of inhibits this motor output. But at a higher level, you really reenact what you see other people do in your premotor cortices.
Hmm. So how do we learn facial expressions?
So you mean how do we learn to understand those of others?
So when I look at you and you're smiling, how do I understand that's a smile?
Well, so what we know, what happens in the brain is that when you see me smile, first you will activate parts of your brain that you normally use to move your face in a similar way, so they're premotor cortices, and then that activates a region we call the insula, which is a part of the brain that's involved really in feeling your own state, kind of your happiness, your disgust, or your pain. So through this double step, so first sharing the facial expression, and then sharing the feeling really behind it, you manage to really get a share of what happens in the other person's mind.
I mean, could it be that we could take back to our example of anchoring before, where I see you smile, I'm looking at your face, I'm getting a happy association, and then through some heavy and learning, I'm starting to learn, and I guess, I don't know whether to say program my mirror neurons, that I then start to feel that you're smiling? Is that correct? Or
I think that's almost correct. The only problem is that what you were saying is that you watch the smile, then you get a happy feeling, and then you associate that happy feeling with the smile. Well, the question then would still be, why do you get this happy feeling?
Well, because I'm in this, let's say we're doing something nice, and I'm a baby, and I look up, and I see you smiling, and so I'm like, well, this feels nice, and he's smiling, and so therefore...
Exactly. So that's what we think is the trick, is actually the fact that parents have the tendency to imitate the facial expressions of their kids. So if the kid is kind of happy playing around, is smiling, is doing coos and boo sounds, and then looks up to his mother, he's going to see his mother smile back at him. So that gives him an opportunity to anchor or associate in happy learning his happiness with the look of a smile. If on the other hand he kind of just fell down a chair because he was kind of standing up on the chair and doing things he shouldn't do, falls down and starts crying, the mother's facial expression will look pretty preoccupied and sad. And that will give him an opportunity to pair his own kind of pain and distress with what the distressed facial expression looks like. So in a way, the parents mirror our own facial expression, and that gives us the opportunity to associate this complex expression, which is a movement of the face, a certain tone in the voice, all of that with an inner state that we experience at that moment. Then once this association has been built up, the next time you'll see just the facial expression, you'll have this recall of the rich emotional feelings that you had in the past.
Mm.
So that said, and that's kind of my point of view, some people believe that we're actually, for the case of facial expression, born with a certain kind of pre-wired set of mirror-type neurons that would allow us to, from birth, so to say, share emotions. But I'm not convinced that that's the case, but the jury is still out there because it's so difficult to actually study brain function in very young children, of course.
And that would, so are you more on the side of neuroplasticity rather than...
Exactly.
So
I think that just the richness of the things we can perceive in other people is so huge that I think that it would be unreasonable to believe that all of that has been pre-wired by our genetic code. There just wouldn't be enough genes in there to pre-wire all of that. And instead, I think that the concept of anchoring, like you call it, or in Habian learning, like I call it, is such a simple principle, this learning of association. And yet, it can get us so far by giving us the opportunity to learn completely new things, and thereby to learn to share them with others. I think it's a much more plausible and powerful tool for building up mirror neurons and understanding other people.
So what do you think is going on with autism? I mean, we've had the broken mirrors theory. I've talked with Simon Baron Cohen about it, and his interview is going to be up shortly on his thoughts on broken mirrors. What are your thoughts on that and autism? And because some of the recent research, they say that mirror neurons that's all wrong, and mirror neurons are not related to autism, and you know, move on to other stuff. What are your thoughts?
Well, so we were very interested in that as well. So part of our interest got triggered by a study that Mirella D'Aperto had done, where she found that if you look in the premotor cortex of children with autism and show them the facial expressions of others, you don't see as much mirroring as you do in kind of typically developing children. So that kind of was part of what triggered this broken mirror kind of idea. Then what we did was we figured, well, okay, let's just scan people ranging in age from kind of young adults around 18 all the way up to people age 50. And we showed them the facial expressions of others. And what we saw was that on average, they were doing just as much mirroring as typically developing individuals. But then when we looked at the different ages, what we saw was that the young adults were still mirroring less than their age-matched controls, whereas the older patients with autism were actually doing more mirroring than typically developing individuals. So the impression that I got out of that is that what may actually happen in individuals with autism is that because they're not so interested as children in the faces of other people, they just don't spend so much time staring at their mother's face, for instance, smiling back. And therefore, it takes longer for them to build up this association between their own inner feelings and what they look like on other people's facial expressions.
I think you're exactly right. do you see it, so you're saying like the motivation is missing. Would you agree with that?
Exactly. Let's say the motivation is not as strong, and because the motivation to seek these biological responses of others isn't as strong, it just takes you longer to get these 100 repetitions we were talking about earlier that would then build up a mirror neuron for that.
And so what are you saying, build up a mirror neuron? Is it being activated, or what do you feel?
Well, so I think what happens is this wiring. So imagine you have neurons in your visual cortex that are now peering at that person's face and seeing a smile. And now you, inside of you, you feel happy at that moment. So that's neural activity somewhere else in the brain, say in the insula. So the neuron in the insula that responds when you're happy is not yet a mirror neuron. But if it's active, say, 100 times together with the sight of a happy facial expression, then this firing together 100 times will create the connection between these neurons that will now be so strong that the next time you just see the smile, it will trigger the activity of the emotional neuron that makes you feel happy. So it's kind of the repeated pairing creates literally a wire that connects those two neurons and now makes the emotional neuron a mirror neuron because it receives the right visual input.
So this is actually the specifics of the Hebbian learning you were talking about.
Exactly, yes. And so you can imagine if it takes, say, 100 times to build up this connection and you're really fascinated by faces, then this may, in just a couple of months, might be enough. If you're more interested in other things, it may take you years to accumulate the same number of kind of paired experiences of your happiness and what happiness looks like in others, and it will just take you a little bit longer for this system to become fully wired up.
Hmm. I mean, that's actually my conclusion precisely.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Yeah, so we're on the same page. But that disagrees with most of the current autism research.
Well, yes and no. I think one of the other very related issue that is coming out as well is the fact that there might be subtle differences as well in the synapses. So the synapses are the parts of the connection between neurons that can become stronger with experience. And it turns out that in some of the few cases where we know what gene is different in subjects with autism, these genes often seem to code the plasticity of these synapses. And what that may mean is that it may also slow down a little bit how quickly you can wire up these mirror neurons, just because those connections may be a bit more conservative and may want a couple more experiences as well to wire up.
So, it could be either that or it could be the motivation. Right.
And I think it may be both, really. It's the motivation might focus on other kind of things, which reduces the chances, let's say, to learn about these emotional intersubjective pairings. And then if there's as well some degree maybe of conservative plasticity, it may take even a little bit longer.
Hmm.
So, but I really agree with you. They're two different things, but I think that they may actually play together to kind of create the kind of slowing down of the development of this mirror system. But I think the motivation plays an enormous role in there.
I agree. So, what about sociopaths and psychopaths?
Well, it's a completely different story.
Because the final result is similar issues in the case as to autism, where there's issues with empathy, right?
Well, so that's kind of the naive view of it. And that's a little bit how we entered the field ourselves. So we were wondering, well, let's look at all the cases where people report reduced empathy, and then see in which of these cases there might be problems with mirror neurons. But what we found was really very different. So what we found in autism, like I was saying, is the fact that the system is actually relatively normal in the adult. It's just that the time course, the way it develops, is a little bit of a different trajectory. When we then looked at psychopath, what we found was a bit different. So if you take a psychopath and you put him in the scanner and you make him feel a bit of pain, you will see the pain areas light up. Then you can show him a movie of somebody else experience pain, and you will see that those pain areas do not light up. So that would suggest, okay, well, they have a broken mirror system. But then what we did is we then asked them, well, now just try to feel what this other person is feeling. And what we saw was that in that case, the psychopathic brain actually activates these pain areas in ways that look completely normal. So in them, it seems that the problem is not that they don't have a functioning kind of empathy or mirror system. Their thing is that they seem to have a gift to turn it on and off whenever they want to. And it just seems to be the case that in normal situations...
You mean that as a gift?
Well, so I personally, of course, don't experience it as a gift because I might be on the wrong side of the pistol.
Yeah.
But they very much report that this thing is a gift. So one of the leading kind of researchers on psychopathy has done lots of interviews with people with psychopathy. And he very much got this impression, and some of the patients were very open about that, that they actually experienced the psychopathy as a gift, because they can do things without the burden of consciousness. So they don't feel bad if they take money from other people. And they think that that's actually a handy thing to have, because then you can get money without kind of feeling bad about it. And so what we saw in the brain is that, let's call it a gift or not, but it's certainly a capacity to silence empathy or activate it, depending on whether you want to or not at that moment. And I think that gives them what makes them so fascinating, say, in Hollywood movies. I mean, if you watch the movie Silence of the Lambs, in 1 second, he's kind of eating the liver of his enemy with a nice glass of Chianti, obviously having turned off his empathy. And the next second, he's there watching Clarice as she first enters the prison and feeling exactly what she is feeling at that moment, her fear and everything, being able to manipulate that to make her do what he wants her to do. And this looked really like a paradox. I mean, on the one hand, they're incredibly cunning and empathic. And on the other case, they seem to lack empathy altogether. And with the scanners, what we basically see is that they indeed have the capacity to turn this mirror system on and off, just depending on whether you tell them to or not. So it's a very voluntary access to this system.
Hmm. So you would say conclusively there's no mirror neurons, there's no real link between mirror neurons and sociopathy and psychopathy?
Well, so what I think is that where the link exists is in the fact that they have a capacity to control this system more so than normal people do. So if you wish, we have a limited capacity to turn the system on and off. And that's what recent research has shown. For instance, if I make you meet two people and I make you play a game with them, one of them is very nice to you, is always sharing his money, and the other one is really unfair to you. And then I can scan you while you see the pain of the fair and the unfair individual. And what I'll see is that you empathize a little bit more with the fair person and a little bit less with the unfair person. So you have some control over this system as well. But if we then look at psychopaths, they seem to be really extreme in their capacity to move this on and off. And that's, I think, what makes them so damaging to society, because the capacity to turn it off, of course, gives you a way to kind of pursue certain goals by harming others and not feel the normal inhibition that most of us feel because we share the pain we do to others. So I think where the situation is really different from autism is that in autism, the people, I think, do not try to turn the system on and off. What happens is that they probably have different interests when they're kids, so the system doesn't really train up much in early childhood. And then when they really get, say, in professional situations where they're interested in physics and it's important for them to get this job, for instance, they genuinely, I think, try to do as well as they can in the interview to really feel what the interviewees want them to say. But they have a little bit this burden of having to catch up with the development of that system. So I think in them, it's not a matter of trying to turn it on and off like psychopaths do. In them, it's really catching up with the development of that system that can be a challenge. So it's, if you wish, on the one hand, the capacity to empathize that's a challenge. And on the other case, it's more the fact that they have the power to turn it on and off so easily that they're not going to socialize in normal ways.
Right. Have you heard of something called the cross-race effect?
No, I haven't.
Or it's also called the other race effect?
Oh, yes. No. I thought you meant race in terms of running for something. Yes, no. So there is a very sad result, I think, from a study of Alessio Avenanti, where he looked at empathy for pain and as a function of race. And what he found was that indeed, if you show a white person a white hand with a needle entering it, you'll activate your pain areas more than if you're a white person and you see a black hand with a needle entering it. And it goes the other way around. So if you're a black participant, you'll activate more of your pain if you see a black hand being poked than if you see a white hand being poked. And this even goes further. So there's a study that was done by Tanya Singer, where she simply told people, okay, you're going to see the pain of a person, and I'm going to tell you whether the person is a fan of the same football team that you like or is a fan of the opposite team. And that, of course, creates a certain sense of he's one of us or he's not one of us. But surprisingly, that was enough to really kind of up and down regulate empathy to some extent. And people were experiencing more empathy for the fan of their own team. So we see that everyone has this capacity to up and down regulate empathy a bit based on things like in-group, out-group, or in race, out race.
Well, so where I was going to talk about that was from the standpoint of, I mean, there's, I think growing up in Australia, like people would say, well, you know, all Chinese look the same, right?
Yes.
And, I mean, could we, going back to the anchoring / Hebbian learning that we were talking about, say that if you haven't hung around a lot of Chinese people, you haven't had the chance to learn their facial expressions as well. And so then you haven't established as much Hebbian learning to understand how they look different, and so then you make mistakes. As an example, I just found online today, some people were talking about how in customer service in stores here in the US, that like if there's a black guy that's working in the store and he goes off to find something, the customer will sometimes confuse him for another black guy that's standing there. Like, they don't realize that it's two guys that are different. They think it's the same guy.
Well, I think you're touching on two points that are slightly different here. So we know that in the brain, actually, the parts of the brain that process identity are different from the parts of the brain that process facial expressions. So facial expressions are things that change on the face, and identity doesn't. So it makes sense that you have two different areas, one specializing in what changes and one in what doesn't change. But so what we know is that in terms of identity, what matters is really a lot of exposure just to faces. So if you just see a lot of faces, even of dogs, you would start to get better at telling different dogs apart. That has nothing to do, I think, with the kind of Hebbian learning and emotions we were talking about before.
Okay.
But you're perfectly right with the fact that, for instance, Asian people express emotions using slightly different cues. So a smile in Asia will often express embarrassment, which happens less in Western countries. And there you're perfectly right that I think that living in Asia, being embarrassed and seeing people with a certain facial expression at that moment with you will help you train up this intuitive association of, oh, well, these facial expressions kind of automatically trigger a feeling of embarrassment in me. So now I understand them in this intuitive way. Whereas if you don't have the chance to really live there, experience these joint emotions with the fitting facial expressions, you have to rely more on the fact that you maybe just read something in The Lonely Planet. Then you have to use more cognitive things. So I think that when it comes to ways of expressing emotions, this kind of emotional anchoring that we were speaking about before is very important and is luckily enough plastic enough that if you go for the first time to a new culture, you might misunderstand them, but then give it some joint experiences and you'll start to understand them. So for instance, something similar happened to me when I moved to Italy. So when I moved there, in the beginning, I very often had the impression while two people were speaking to each other that they were quite intense about it, almost kind of angry at each other. Then after living there a couple of years and starting to interact with them and starting to adopt similar tones of voice just to express emotion rather than negative emotions, now it's very intuitive for me that when I hear them speak in a certain way, it's not actually anger, but just passion.
Yeah. I guess that covers most of what I wanted to talk about. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I think indeed you made us cover a lot of interesting ground. Two more things that are important, I think. In thinking about the mirror system and the kind of sharing of activations that we find, a lot of people jump to the conclusion that, okay, well, we have these mirror systems that make us share the emotions of others, so that automatically makes us good people, right? That makes us automatically empathic and moral people. Well, there I think we need to be a little bit careful, because what this kind of mirror system gives us is the opportunity to share what goes on in other people. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we will then go out and help them, simply because it's a motivation towards doing that. Because, of course, if I see somebody sad and I really share the sadness, then I want to make him feel better because that will make me feel better. But still, in very many situations, my own interest might take over and I might just turn away to kind of lose that emotion. So I think the mirror system gives us a real chance to feel what goes on in others. And I think that's a strong foundation for being ethical and doing the right thing, but it still takes an additional layer of really being willing to sacrifice some of my own interests to help others, to really create moral behavior. And we need to be aware of that and be aware of the fact that it takes more for good behavior than just the mirror system.
Well, on the scale, that's like, you know, you're not a psychopath, but but being able to turn away from someone who's sad is like a more normal person's version of, you know, on the weak end of the scale, and if you're really hardcore,
exactly,
then you're a psychopath.
Exactly. I think that's perfectly right. But I think one of the observations that I always find amazing is that if you may have heard of the golden rule, have you?
Mm-hmm.
So there's basically, throughout the most varied religions, there's this basic rule to say, do unto others what you would like them to do unto you. Now, if you think about it, that's a very odd way of expressing it, right? What you should do to others is what they want you to do to them, right? That would be the best way to do something for them. But the fact that all these wise men expressed it in that way, kind of think about how you would feel, and it will help you do the right things for others, is really exactly what we find the mirror system to do for you. It allows you to feel how you would feel in the place of that other person. So I think that these forms of ethics that are done through the golden rule are so effective because they really embrace the biology of the brain and they take advantage of this capacity that we have to feel how we would feel in the stead of other people. And I find that quite amazing when just in the way how brain science makes us discover maybe the why of the ethics that have dominated our religions for thousands of years.
That's actually a great note to end on, except I do have a really important question I need to ask you.
Go ahead.
So, just on mirror neurons, is it a binary firing for different actions? Like, is there a different mirror neuron that fires for a monkey when it sees you with a peanut versus when you're turning around versus when you're holding something versus when you fall over? Like, are these different mirror neurons that fire?
Yes, they are. So it's not completely binary. So what you'll imagine, you have a mirror neuron that responds when you grasp something with what we call a pincer grasp. So that would be just between your index and your thumb. And now you test this neuron either while showing somebody grasping with his kind of whole hand, the way you would grasp a heavy bottle, or, for instance, kicking something. Then what you'll see is it's not completely binary. You'll see that the mirror neuron for the pincer grip will respond a little bit still to the whole hand prehension, but not at all, say, to kicking. So it's a kind of a graded response. But you have so many neurons with kind of different preferences that kind of the sum of all of these graded responses gives you a very clear indication of what action somebody else is doing.
So it is that there are groups and sets of different mirror neurons that handle different types of actions.
Exactly, yes. So you can look at it a bit as if you had a vocabulary of actions, where each word, like grasping, falling, kicking, is all kind of represented by a certain group of neurons. And what you then see while you watch the actions of other people is that those very same kind of individual groups will become reactivated. So you really reactivate the vocabulary of that particular action. And it's then the combination. Imagine you see somebody do a complex action, like making coffee in the morning. That is kind of the chaining together of different neurons, each one coding a single element of this action. So you'll grasp the coffee filter, you'll put it in the machine, then you'll grasp the coffee powder with a spoon and put it in the machine. Each element is a word or a neuron in the brain, and then the whole complex action sequence is represented by the kind of sequential firing of these different neurons, a bit like the words can get put together in a sentence to give it a more complex meaning, but you could rearrange the words or the action in a new sentence that would have a complete different meaning. And then if you observe somebody else's action, you can kind of map each one of the elements of that complex action onto your own motor program for that single element, thereby creating for the first time maybe in your brain this chain of action that you've seen him do.
Let me read this to you just really quickly. So there was a group at NYU that did a study of the mirror system in individuals with autism, and they said they tested autistic and control individuals to observe and execute a small number of movements, e.g. rock, papers, scissors, yes, thumbs up, and so on. And they said that autistic individuals on average executed not only robust responses, but they're basically the same as the controls. So they said then that it's not mirror neurons that's the problem. But we've just discussed that there are different sets of mirror neurons, so they may have in fact been doing the wrong tests. Would you agree with that?
Well, that is certainly... So there's two elements there. The first one is to say that indeed they might have looked at such basic actions that by the time you look at adults with autism, mirror neurons for those basic actions are completely in place. So one of the problem might be that if they had conducted the same study with young children with autism, they may have been able to see differences even for those simpler actions. But then the other thing you're perfectly right with is that maybe if you would have looked at, say, emotional facial expressions instead of these basic actions, things may have looked different again.
Right. And you know, it could have been basic stuff like smiling or something else, or it could have been turning around or waving or, you know, like, you know...
More subtle body languages rather than those really kind of prototypical smiles that anybody with autism can deal with by the time they're adults. But it's maybe the more subtle things, the little twinkle in the eye that if you have been really attentive to it and experienced certain emotional situation, you will start to read as really reflecting, for instance, playfulness or a slight embarrassment. And those subtle cues may remain a challenge a little bit longer.
Right. I had to go on, this is off the guy's resume that, like, did the testing at NYU, and I think they did the wrong tests. And so you would agree with me with that?
Yes, I do think so. I mean, what the test does, and I think that is important, is kind of very clearly show that it's not true that individuals with autism have a generally broken mirror system. It's a lot more subtle than that. And then to look at the subtleties, maybe, of the differences, they use too simple a test.
Great. All right, that's what I wanted to cover. So, Christian, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for your interest. I've really enjoyed the interview.